This is KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD, a service of Rio Salado College. We're on the web at kjzz.org. It's mostly sunny, 88 degrees right now in Phoenix at 11 o'clock.
Immigration reform has been talked about by a number of Republican presidential candidates and will no doubt come up during tonight's debate. But will farm workers specifically be discussed? I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk about agricultural workers, what reforms may happen, and how significant they are to the U.S. and Arizona economies. Plus, immigration has shown up a lot in art, but Joshua Ocone has created video installations that include recreations of controversial events, including a protest in southern Arizona from the summer of 2014. I'll ask Ocone about the intersection of art and politics. Also, we recently talked with Arizona Republic editorial cartoonist Pulitzer Prize winner Steve Benson about his job. Today, we'll check in with David Fitzsimmons, who expresses his opinions via cartoon and other forms for the Arizona Daily Star. And best-selling novelist and part-time Arizona resident J.A. Jantz is back with her latest murder mystery. We'll talk about her settings and characters. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Training moderate Syrian rebels to take on the Islamic State is off to a slow start, in the words of a senior U.S. military official. As NPR's Tom Bowman reports, General Lloyd Austin, the officer who oversees the region that includes Syria and Iraq, says the U.S. will not reach its goals by year's end.
The U.S. strategy against the Islamic State is to train local ground forces in both Syria and Iraq and provide them with U.S. air power. The Pentagon expected to train some 5,400 Syrian rebels by December. General Austin was asked by senators how many rebels are now in the fight.
It's a small number, and the ones that are in the fight is, we're talking four or five. So the new Syrian force program has gotten off to a slow start.
Some of those first rebels were captured by more radical forces in Syria or were unable to get into Syria from Turkey. Officials say another 100 rebels will be trained in the coming weeks. Tom Bowman, NPR News, Washington.
Months after tensions flared over Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's address to the U.S. Congress, Netanyahu is returning to Washington, this time for talks with President Obama. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest says the visit in November will reinforce an already strong alliance.
Prime Minister Netanyahu's visit to the United States is a deep demonstration of the deep and enduring bonds between the United States and Israel, as well as our unprecedented cooperation to further enhance Israel's security.
The U.S. and Israeli leaders are expected to address the Iran nuclear deal, which Netanyahu, like the GOP majority in Congress, vehemently opposes. Oklahoma death row inmate Richard Glossop is getting a two-week reprieve from execution, which was just hours away. A state appeals court has authorized a last-minute stay for a man convicted of ordering the murder of his boss, Barry Ventrese. Glossop's attorneys say they have new evidence suggesting their client was framed. Poverty throughout the U.S. shows no sign of abating. NPR's Pam Fessler says a new report reveals that almost 1 in 7 people in the U.S. lived in poverty last year, roughly the same as the year before.
The U.S. poverty rate last year was 14.8%. That means that almost 47 million people lived in poverty, which the U.S. Census Bureau defines as about $24,000 or less for a family of four. Poverty was highest among children. More than 21% of those ages 18 and younger were poor. The government also reported that median household income was almost $54,000 last year, not statistically different than the year before. The census found that 33 million people in the U.S. lacked health insurance, which was a drop of almost 3 percentage points from 2013. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
At last check on Wall Street, the Dow was up 105 points at 16,704. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Farmers Insurance, out to educate everybody about common insurance gaps that can be costly, so that no one falls victim to them again. Farmers Insurance. Know the gaps. Learn more at farmers.com/innercircle.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. Striking drivers and mechanics will vote on a deal to end Tucson's city bus strike later today. Professional Transit Management, the company that runs buses for SunTran, reached a tentative agreement with Teamsters Union Local 104 on a new contract at 1 o'clock this morning. A spokesman for the union says members will vote on the deal this afternoon. The agreement is a two-year deal. SunTran's unionized workers walked off the job 42 days ago in a conflict over higher wages and better safety conditions. Storm damage is preventing the Phoenix VA healthcare system from accepting emergency room admissions for the second time in about 2 weeks. 39 patient rooms are currently out of service after another powerful weather system rolled through Phoenix Monday night. To deal with the loss of space, VA staff has rotated patients to different beds within the hospital and canceled some procedures that require overnight stays, says VA spokeswoman Jean Schaefer.
We ended up with water coming in through the windows, and in some buildings on our campus, water came in through the roof.
On August 31st, monsoons forced the VA to transfer patients to other hospitals. Schaefer says the VA had just returned to full operations last Friday. Room-to-room damage assessments were ongoing Tuesday morning.
From the KJZZ Newsroom, I'm Kathy Ritchie. U.S. Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake sent a letter to the FAA to address community concerns about the flight path changes at Phoenix Sky Harbor. The senators are asking the FAA to respond to questions about what led to the changes and how the agency will engage residents moving forward. The city of Phoenix is suing over the changes, which have led to increased aircraft noise in some neighborhoods. This is not the first time the two Republicans have reached out to the FAA. The flight path changes were implemented nearly a year ago.
Should be a mostly sunny day today in the valley, a slight chance for some showers, a high near 96 degrees, and about the same tomorrow. We're expecting mostly sunny and a high of 97.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, featuring the 2016 Forester with 32 mpg and enhanced safety features for anything life throws at you. Online at shopsubaru.com.
It's mostly sunny right now in Phoenix and 91 degrees at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about agricultural workers, what reforms may happen, and how significant they are to the U.S. and Arizona economies. Plus, immigration has shown up in a lot of art, but Joshua Ocone has created video installations that include recreations of controversial events, including a protest in southern Arizona from the summer of 2014. I'll ask Ocone about the intersection of art and politics. We'll also check in with best-selling novelist and part-time Arizona resident J.A. Jantz. She's back with her latest murder mystery. We'll talk about her settings and characters and whether it's any easier being a female writer these days. We start today's program with a continuing discussion around Governor Doug Ducey's proposed increased use of state land trust funds for K-12 education. Superintendent of Public Instruction Diane Douglas is calling for an immediate increase of money to public schools with a focus on teacher pay. In his column in today's Arizona Republic, editorial columnist Bob Robb took on some critics of the governor's plan, and he joins me now. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
So do you believe that Republican lawmakers and members of the education community have both negotiated in good faith to settle the K-12 funding lawsuit? And if so, what's taking so long to get a settlement?
Well, I have no idea whether they have negotiated in good faith. I do believe that the schools made a good settlement offer in terms of being willing to forego what's owed for past neglect of inflation if it is made whole on a going forward basis. But there is a good faith dispute over how you calculate what intervening inflation has been. And that creates a gap of $262 million that hasn't been bridged and, in my judgment, won't be bridged until all the last hurrah of the court appeals is over.
At its core, whether someone agrees or disagrees with Governor Ducey's proposal, if it gets on the ballot and if it's approved by voters, that funding wouldn't kick in for a couple of years. Can a negotiated settlement on the lawsuit we just talked about at the very least provide a bridge to that land trust money? And can people look at that in a practical sense and see it that way?
Well, the governor proposes that his increased funding actually kick in next budget year.
All right.
Now, that will be a bit tricky won't be approved until midway through that budget year, and so schools won't be able to anticipate it in advance. I believe that the huge savings account that the state currently has could be tapped to provide some bridge funding until the governor's increased proceeds from the state land trust were to kick in for a year or two. And in fact, the legislative leadership have indicated a willingness to increase the amount of money that they've already kicked in by another $100 million a year. What there won't be a willingness to do is to commit to fully what the schools claim and that a Superior Court judge has determined is owed for inflation on a permanent adjustment ongoing basis, because there's just too much uncertainty as to whether state revenues would be able to sustain that on a going forward basis.
In your column today, you laid it out this way. I'm going to say a somewhat covert push for a tax increase. Lay that out for us, for people who aren't seeing it that way.
Well, it's about the sustainability of agreeing to the permanent adjustment that the schools are asking for and that a Superior Court judge has determined is owed. There is enough money in savings, approximately $785 million, to pay that for a year or two. But being able to pay it beyond that would require an increase in the growth of state revenues beyond what we've seen over the last few years. Now, getting back to the historic average of 6% to 8% growth per year would do the trick. But right now, we're stuck at about 4%. The calls for the legislature to simply give up its appeal, agree to what the Superior Court judge has decided, is going to bake in pressure for a tax increase if there's not an acceleration in the growth of state revenues in a relatively short period of time.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A couple of more minutes left with Arizona Republic editorial columnist Bob Robb. Bob, a tax increase advocated by this governor would be a non-starter. But based on financial commitments the state has and the nearly universal belief that more money needs to be spent on education, what's gonna really push this through? I mean, can there be? It does seem like everyone we hear from, public policy folks and folks who are advocates and whatnot, well, Arizona's not spending enough. Whether they're spending it the right way or whatnot, there just isn't enough money being spent. So, at any point, does a tax increase get any momentum, or does Governor Ducey really hold enough power here where it's just not going anywhere?
Well, I think that the governor's proposal to increase funding from the state land trust kills any chance of an initiative enacting a tax increase, because the governor has shown how you can get more money to education without a tax increase. So I think, even though I support a tax increase, I think it's off the table politically for now. The legislature isn't going to do it, and I think Ducey's proposal has effectively doomed any chance of an initiative, which is why I've proposed that we have a combination of drawing down on the savings account for the next year or two to increase funding for education, then relying on the governor's proposal for the next 5 years. That gets us out to about 2022, with the schools getting what they are owed, although not in the way that they say that they are owed it, but the amount of money is the same. Over that period of time, we'll be able to find out whether state revenue growth bounces back to its historic average, which produces enough money to continue the larger commitment to education without jeopardizing other state programs and even increasing funding for education by more. Or if our current 4% is the new norm, in which case I do believe that the prospects for a tax increase become very real and certainly a discussion of it becomes inevitable.
Let's go to my favorite part of this, which is the politics of this all this situation, which is how do you think Governor Ducey has handled the situation overall? And is he aided by Superintendent Diane Douglas coming out with some of her positions? Because many people still consider her to be really off in her own area, let's put it that way, to put it gently. So is he helped by that?
Well, certainly it creates a vacuum in terms of leadership on education issues. She's not nearly as effective a nemesis for the governor as State Treasurer Jeff DeWitt is proving to be on questions of what the governor's proposal does to the integrity of the state land trust on a long-term basis. But I describe the governor's proposal as sound policy and brilliant politics when it was first introduced, and I continue to think it deserves that description. It gets money to the schools, basically what they say they're being owed, without a tax increase, which the governor proposes and has no support in the legislature. And the and it also, in my judgment, puts off the table for at least this election cycle any outside effort through an initiative to do a tax increase. So I think it has put the governor in the driver's seat, and I think people who want to see more money go into education need to accept that political reality and ride that horse.
And Bob, briefly, final question. What does this do to Jeff DeWitt? Is he making himself a bigger star, perhaps, than he had before, or is he setting himself for an early career burial?
I don't know that it would jeopardize his chances of getting reelected treasurer. He would have to be challenged in the Republican primary. I don't sense that the Ducey folks are inclined towards that kind of retaliatory politics. I do think he will end up being the odd man out because I don't think there's a practical alternative to, in the short term, getting more money into education than what the governor has proposed. And I believe that the alarms that he's sounding on the effect on the state land trust will prove to have been exaggerated and overstated.
Arizona Republic editorial columnist Bob Robb. Bob, thanks as always.
Good to be with you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. This evening, many of the Republican presidential candidates will be on stage and on CNN engaging in their second debate. There's little doubt the subject of immigration reform will come up, but it'll probably be focused on border fences and deportations. One topic that may not be considered that we'll talk about right now is agricultural employment. Earlier today, the Migration Policy Institute held a panel discussion on the subject in Washington, D.C. One of the participants was Philip Martin, chair of the UC Comparative Immigration and Integration Program at the University of California, Davis. And he joins me now for a few minutes. Professor Martin, thank you.
Thank you.
So what does the agricultural workforce generally look like right now in the U.S., especially in California? Are most from Mexico or Guatemala? Are most of them older?
Most farm workers were born in Mexico, and the slowdown in Mexico-U.S. migration since the 2008-09 recession has meant that farm workers are getting older. 10 years ago, the average age of farm workers was about 29. Now the average age of hired workers on crop farms is about 37. So we still have largely a Mexican-born labor force, but it is an aging labor force. It's settling down. Over half of farm workers are married with children in the United States, and that workforce is aging.
How are employers responding to that? Are there ideas they have to go forward to get younger workers and newcomers?
Well, employers that have a sort of a 4S strategy. And those 4S's are, first, try to satisfy current workers. Farm work is a job. It's not a career. So it's a kind of an industry a little bit akin to fast food where people enter, they stay in it for 5 to 10 years, and then most move on to another job. So one thing you could do is to keep current farm workers in agriculture longer. How could you do that? You could raise wages, improve benefits, improve supervision, do things like that. So satisfy is one response. A second is you could stretch the current labor force. How do you stretch it? You use mechanical aids to make the work easier. Put a conveyor belt in the field so that people don't have to carry the harvested fruits and vegetables to the end of the row, and instead they can just put it on a machine and that will take it. The third is to substitute for farm workers. That's mechanization. There's lots of labor-saving mechanization going on in many, many crops, including chili peppers in Arizona and in New Mexico. But of course, people are always better than machines. And so long as workers are available, then there's less incentive to do machines. And finally, the fourth S is supplement the current workforce. And that means bringing in H-2A workers, mostly from, but not exclusively, from Mexico.
Let me come back to what you said about workers always being better than machines. Presumably, employers realize that. And going forward, do you see a reason or do you see the possibility that employers will really see this and say, okay, what you laid out as the four S's make a lot of sense to us? Or will they say, well, I don't really want to provide more pay or more benefits to these kinds of workers? Or will they realize perhaps there's a limited number of them, so let's take care of them?
Well, I think that's a good point, but I think the way farming is a business, and the purpose of the business is to make a profit. And the argument that farmers would make against raising wages is that if we raise wages but there are no additional workers available, that is, U.S. workers don't want to do farm work and new people are not coming in, then all that we are doing, farmers would say, is shuffling workers from one farm to another. So the argument about the raising the wages and the increase in the benefits, farmers think really won't get them that much more work. What it will do, though, is higher wages will give more incentives to make current workers more productive and to speed up labor-saving mechanization. So that's the kind of consideration that's going on for remember, the average educational level of Mexican-born farm workers in the United States is 7 years of Mexican education. The average educational level of Mexicans in Mexico is 9 years. Mm. So the Mexicans in the United States are from rural areas of Mexico with low levels of education. And that means coming to the United States does give them much higher wages. But it also then often limits their ability to move from farm jobs to non-farm jobs in the United States. Many did, especially during the construction boom before the big recession. But that door has slowed down a little bit. It might be picking up as the housing recovery takes hold.
As I mentioned in the introduction to our conversation, there's the big CNN Republican presidential debate tonight. Does the industry in general worry, should it worry, about talk from presidential candidates, especially related to increasing border security, trying to deport undocumented immigrants? Does that make people in the agricultural business nervous?
Well, most of agribusiness, as it's called, leans Republican. And I think there's a lot of frustration among many of the largest growers who tend to be Republican with the candidates. I mean, the Republican Party seems to actually be divided into three camps when it comes to immigration. There's the Donald Trump, deport them all and build a wall. There's the Jeb Bush, family values don't stop at the Rio Grande, give them a path to legal status, but maybe not to U.S. citizenship because they might vote for the other party. And there's the Paul Ryan libertarian approach, which is let in as many who want to come, but make sure they don't get any welfare benefits. That's kind of get rid of the minimum wage, let everybody float to their own level. So the Republican Party has kind of got a civil war going on between those three camps. And it's not clear to me exactly which of those three camps will wind up coming out on top.
Philip Martin is chair of the UC Comparative Immigration and Integration Program at the University of California at Davis. We have just tapped the surface of this topic, but Professor Martin, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll get the Arizona perspective. on agricultural workers. And later this hour, best-selling novelist J.A. Jantz. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony, kicking off its 2015-16 season as Tito Munoz conducts Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, September 18th and 19th at Symphony Hall. Tickets at phoenixsymphony.org.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Be with us today at 1 for BBC NewsHour. Taking a look at some temperatures around the state right now, cloudy skies, 63 degrees in Flagstaff. It's partly sunny and 73 in Prescott. Casa Grande reporting sunny skies and 90 degrees. It's partly sunny and 86 in Tucson. Fair skies, 90 degrees in Yuma. Checking Valley traffic right now, eastbound on the Loop 101. The earlier accident has been cleared at Cave Creek Road. You may still see some backup through there until it clears out. We've got a convenient, affordable way for you to support the news and information you rely on. Are you in? Become a sustaining member and get the benefits. It's easy and secure. Click I'm in at kjzz.org to get started. Mostly sunny right now in Phoenix and 91 degrees at 11:25.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. For a more Arizona-focused part of the conversation about agricultural workers, I'm joined by Paul Brierley, who leads the U of A's Yuma Center of Excellence for Desert Agriculture in Yuma. Paul, thank you for a few minutes.
You bet, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
So is Arizona facing the same challenges the professor talked about as California in terms of finding new farm workers? Do we have the same sort of average age or folks who've been in the job for quite a while?
We do. We face the same things, and in some ways I'd say we have an even tougher situation because some of the Arizona-specific legislation has gone through and caused some of the immigrant labor to look to states like California, New Mexico, and Texas rather than come to Arizona. So we do have a very serious concern about worker shortages.
For those of us who don't think about it maybe as much as we should, how important is agriculture, how important is Yuma agriculture to the state's economy, and how important does that make the agricultural workers?
So in the state, the Arizona agriculture industry is now contributing $17 billion a year to the economy, and Yuma alone is over $3 billion. We, in Yuma during the winter, we're the leafy green lettuce capital of the world and produce close to 90% of the leafy greens for the whole country. So we're not just talking about a product. We're talking about a food supply and what people eat three times per day. And it is, you know, agriculture is quite a few of the original five C's of Arizona and still fairly a fairly big contributor to the state's economy.
Paul, are there certain things you're seeing? You're involved in this Yuma Center of Excellence. I'm wondering, are you seeing certain trends or changes, maybe even those tied specifically to technology, that are changing the industry, maybe making it better?
Yeah, absolutely, no question. You know, the trend being that there's worker shortages, what do you do to address that? Well, one thing is you choose crops that that don't require as much labor. Now, that's not really a choice in the Yuma area with produce, but in some places, rather than growing chilies or vegetables, they can grow corn or cotton or beans. And then they look for other labor sources. They look for prison labor and foreign asylum seekers and things like that. But certainly one of the more exciting is the implementation of technology. And one of the things that's actually being used a fair amount in the Yuma area are mechanical lettuce thinners. So rather than sending a whole crew of workers through with hose to thin out the crop, they're working on, they have commercialized, and they're, you know, I'd almost call it a beta version, that they're still they still take a lot of work and someone walking behind them to make sure they're working right. But these mechanical thinners that take the place of the crews, and there's work being done on ways to mechanically harvest crops and ways to irrigate that are automated and don't require as much labor. And then you get into drones and sensors and things like that. They're all ways of monitoring a crop, taking care of a crop, being as productive and sustainable as we can, and not relying on that labor that everybody's worried won't be there for forever.
Yeah, Paul, coming back to the phrase Professor Martin used, which is that workers will always be better than mechanization or mechanical works and mechanical items and whatnot. Do you believe that? Do you believe that this will there always be a place for people who will really get down and have an idea of what's going on? They're not just haven't just programmed something. People can actually look for different items and have the experience.
Well, I've got to say that some of this work is very, very tough and does require humans. I mean, it's called unskilled labor, but if you or I were to go out there and try to cut the lettuce the way that they do and choose the right ones, and there's a skill to it, Steve, I guarantee you. However, I also look back and I see pictures of cotton harvesting that happened, you know, less than 100 years ago, and it was people out there with bags picking cotton off the plants as they walked through the rows, and that's unimaginable now. It just could never happen. And so I'm an engineer in a past life, and I would never be one to say that mechanization wouldn't be able to eventually perform most, if not all, of these jobs. But it is expensive, and it's a give and take of the costs of different ways of doing it. But I think as availability of labor wanes and costs go up, then that certainly makes technology a lot more feasible.
Paul Brierley leads the U of A's Yuma Center of Excellence for Desert Agriculture in Yuma. Paul, thanks for the conversation. We appreciate it.
You bet, Steve. Thank you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We just discussed how the renewed political debate over immigration reform may affect farm workers and related industries. But in the summer of 2014, there was a different feel, as KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reported.
There were rumors recently arrived migrant children could be bused to Oracle on Tuesday morning, which is what drew both protesters and supporters of the young immigrants. Bruce Bemis lives nearby and has lots of concerns.
Health and diseases, criminality. How old are these kids? We don't even know that.
Another resident, Eldon Rhodes, said once the bus transporting children appears, his goal is to turn the bus around. That's what protesters did in Murrieta, California, earlier this month.
I don't think the driver will run over us if we don't get out of the street. But if they do, Nathan Hale said, he only had one life to give for his country.
That was Jude Joffe Block reporting from Oracle, Arizona in July of 2014. Artist Joshua Ocone took that incident and created a video installation called Oracle that included the town's residents recreating their protest. He also came up with Octopus in 2011. That featured Guatemalan day laborers reenacting their military training in the parking lot of a Los Angeles Home Depot. That creation is now being exhibited at ASU's downtown gallery space through October the 3rd. We reached Joshua Ocone in Mexico. Could you characterize yourself as an artist when you are creating art? What are you trying to accomplish, and what does the medium you have chosen allow you to do?
The medium that I use, I describe it as a hybrid of a video installation and performance, because I kind of use aspects of all these different traditions, and I kind of made my own language, hybridizing all of those. But I also have a lot of influence from other traditions. Like, for instance, I'm heavily influenced by the documentary.
Would art be as satisfying, I guess I'll use the word, for you without the clear political elements that you have brought to Oracle, to Octopus?
Art is inherently political. I mean, there is no way of making our art outside of a political paradigm. So I think not always artists assume this, but I think that, I mean, making art is taking a stand, even if it's in a very obvious or not so obvious way.
Let's go specifically to Oracle. For a lot of people, when they witnessed the actual scene of what was going on in Oracle, for some who were not as emotionally involved, it almost seemed theatrical in and of itself, and you went in and recreated the situation. Would you mind giving us a brief background, reminding people of what happened in Oracle and why it affected you in such a way that you wanted to recreate it?
In 2014, there were thousands, almost 60,000 of unaccompanied kids from Central America, basically from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, that went to the U.S. And that massive immigration of children triggered a few very big protests. One took place in Murrieta in California, and the other one in Oracle, which is a small town in Arizona. To me, it was very moving to see, on the one hand, the images of these children arriving, and also I was very shocked to see the images of a lot of people reacting against these kids or basically protesting so that these kids would not be allowed in the U.S.
You actually were able to get residents of Oracle to reenact? Was there a considerable amount of convincing going into that, or were people openly interested in doing it?
People were interested in doing it because the way I basically pitched the idea to them is that I told them that I was investigating the contradictions between global economy and nationalism, and the way, you know, the contradictions between these two different paradigms and the side effects. I mean, I specifically work with the Arizona Border Protectors, which are members of the group that organized this protest. They are very much interested in this. I mean, they are very critical of the government not working for the common people, the common good, but working for corporations. And they, in a way, feel betrayed. And that's one of the reasons why they are angry. And they are not necessarily angry at the kids or at the immigrants themselves, but they're angry at what they perceive as the government not really working for common people's interest. I guess where we depart is in that they see and understand nationalism as a solution.
How symbolic, then, did the children of Oracle become in the greater sense of what we're talking about, whether it's nationalism or something even on a smaller scale?
One of the things to learn is that we are all in the same boat. I mean, we are interconnected and we live in the same world. And when you try to deny this fact and think of your nation as a bubble that's really not connected to the outside, that really goes against the way the world is working. And I think these children become the kind of side effect of that reality. That's where, you know, in the border is where this reality kind of becomes materialized in a very evident way.
You seem to have a tremendous amount of nerve, in addition to having artistic skill. And I think about, again, using the residents of Oracle. We go back to Octopus, which had Guatemalan day laborers in a Home Depot in California. I mean, it's this scene, watching it, of having people sort of push their shopping carts right past this military training, as it were, was incredible.
So in the piece, I was hoping to reflect their invisibility. In other words, the fact that they're there, but they're not there in the sense that they don't have rights in the same way that everyone else does. And so I asked them to reenact this civil war, their civil war, and I started shooting video. And then, sure enough, people around them, I mean, the shoppers from the Home Depot, pretty much ignore them. So it's a very uncanny and weird feeling when you're watching the video. It's almost as if you're watching two realities that are kind of two different dimensions, because they're completely ignored, and it's as if there is no connection, even though they are occupying the same space at the same time.
Artist Joshua Ocone, he's behind the video installations called Oracle and Octopus. Octopus is currently being exhibited at ASU's downtown gallery space through October the 3rd. And still to come on Here and Now, we'll meet editorial cartoonist and commentator David Fitzsimmons. And then later on, best-selling novelist J.A. Jantz. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Moores & Cabot Investments and D.N. Griebel in their Mesa branch. Moores & Cabot is a 125-year-old national wealth management firm that is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and SIPC.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. Taking a look at Valley traffic on I-10 eastbound right now, there's a crash on the Chandler Boulevard exit ramp. A mostly sunny day today in the valley, a slight chance for some showers. Otherwise, we'll see a high near 96 degrees. About the same tomorrow, the high expected to be 97 and 99 on Friday. KJZZ thanks Terry for donating her Chevy Impala to support her favorite shows. You can donate your vehicle too by visiting cars.kjzz.org and thanks. Here and Now from Boston is coming up today at 12. We'll get the latest on tonight's GOP presidential debate and why it may be pivotal for some candidates. It's mostly sunny, 91 degrees right now in Phoenix at 11:40.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Last month, I talked with Arizona Republic editorial cartoonist and Pulitzer Prize winner Steve Benson about where his ideas come from and what sort of outlet for commentary cartooning can be. But Benson is not the only cartoonist working for a major newspaper in the state. David Fitzsimmons is a cartoonist, humor columnist, and blogger at the Arizona Daily Star, and you can find him online at the paper's site, Tucson.com. And David Fitzsimmons joins me for a few minutes from Southern Arizona. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm pretty good, Steve. I'm really delighted to be here on KJZZ. I'm here, and I'm here now.
I don't want to pigeonhole you as a cartoonist, because we'll get to other areas of your career. But how did you become a cartoonist? How did you decide that's a good creative outlet for my personality, my point of view?
Well, I have the perfect background in that I have no useful skills whatsoever. I come
join
from
the club.
Military
I'm with you there.
Family.
Yeah.
Okay, so you understand. So I come from a military family, and I was heading into ROTC. My beautiful brothers both returned from Vietnam, slapped the officer training manual out of my hand, said, find some other way to contribute, because you're the kind of guy who'd be killed first day out, probably by your own men. So at the time, I was drawing cartoons for the campus newspaper, the Arizona Wildcat, and I won some regional awards, and I was encouraged to pursue it. And now I'm 60,000 years old, and I've got 700 newspapers, and I'm irritating readers around the world.
So generally, who or what are your favorite subjects for ridicule?
Oh, Arizonans, my people. my people. My favorite people to ridicule are those who afflict the comfortable. I know it's a wretched cliche, but it's true. Yeah, I love to go after the black hats shamelessly. And, of course, I'm political. I'm a liberal, so it's pretty easy for me to identify the black hats here in Arizona, where I'm sort of akin to being a termite on Noah's Ark.
Now, do you feel even more like a termite because you're in Southern Arizona, which to some in the state would say that's like one of the last bastions of liberalism in the state?
Oh, it is. You know, it's because of the University of Arizona, which is a little bit of Berkeley surrounded by Adobe and barbed wire. And, I love working in Tucson, Arizona. It's such a curious city. It has all the great problems that face our country on a microcosmic scale. And not only that, well, I have Phoenix to the north. I have you folks to pick on. This is paradise for a satirist. It's very true what John Stewart often said about Arizona, that it's the meth lab of democracy. And as a satirist, I couldn't be more grateful to be working here. It's almost too easy. In fact, I was sitting next to a New York Times columnist, Anna Quinlan, a couple of years ago at an event I was emceeing, and she said, "What do you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm a satirist in Arizona." And she said, "I can't respect that. That's too easy."
Yes, right. As you said, it sort of writes itself. Now, there are those who've expressed frustration over the years about the so-called state of Maricopa. You kind of alluded to it, how everything focuses on Phoenix and its suburbs. What are your thoughts on that? Does it feel like Tucson's the forgotten child sometimes?
Tucson is the stepchild of Phoenix. And, you know, it's just there's a Zen quality to it that I accept. It's just demographically, numerically, that's just the way it is. That the bigger brother is the big brother, and that's just the way it is politically. But I certainly don't mind holding a minority view. And like I said, it's a target-rich environment for me. And I wouldn't be nearly as happy in a more progressive state like Mississippi or Utah. I prefer this madcap, wacky state for material. And being in Tucson, you know, I get to throw rocks up at Phoenix, and I really don't have to pay a severe price for it, like my dear friend Steve Benford.
Now, are you? Would you characterize yourself as an artiste or no? I mean, are you good? Are you a good drawer? Or are you just a good satirist?
Yeah, I would say I'm a writer first and foremost, and I just happen to have the ability to draw, which I relied upon heavily as a career path for the past 30 years. But I'm also a humor columnist. I also do stand-up. I travel. I speak at conferences a great deal. So I'm very fortunate that I get to make use of all these gifts to better mankind.
How close are you watching tonight's presidential debate on CNN? Is there someone... If you force yourself to watch it, is there someone you're going to be focused on? It seems like Donald Trump is too easy a target.
Donald Trump is too easy a target, but readers can't get enough of Trump being picked on and taunted by we satirists. But I am so loving watching these debates. You know, I'm going to get on a tweet circle with some of my friends, and we just tweet back and forth, and I just savor watching it. And, you know, from my political vantage point, man, it's heavenly because of the positions they all espouse, which to me are not going to be fruitful and they're not positive and they're not really constructive for the country. So it's heaven for me.
So based on what you've said about your liberal point of view, do you feel like you're on another planet when you watch them?
I do feel like I'm on another planet for a number of reasons. Well, one is religion. You know, I would count myself as a Christian, but yet I hear so much of Christianity and God being used by the candidates. I find that deeply troubling and disturbing, since most of the economic philosophies that they espouse to me are anything but Christian. And, you know, I have to say, you know, I grew up in a military family. I would argue I'm a moderate centrist, but of course, by Arizona standards, which is so far to the right, my television set moved out to the carport, that I guess I would be considered a Bolshevik or a communist by some.
Well, David
Fitzsimmons,
yeah. Well, yeah, as you're the first Bolshevik I've ever had on the program, so thanks for that. And
oh, my pleasure. It's a delight to be here with you.
David Fitzsimmons is a cartoonist, satirist, blogger at the Arizona Daily Star, and as you mentioned, all over the world. You can find him online at the paper's site, Tucson.com. David, great to connect with you. Thanks.
Oh, my pleasure. A treat talking with you. You take care.
Best-selling novelist J.A. Jantz has two home bases, one in Tucson and the other in Seattle, and a number of protagonists who inhabit both of those places. Her latest book, Dance of the Bones, features two of her recurring leads, J.P. Beaumont and Brandon Walker. We caught up with J.A. Jantz on the road in Oregon before she flies back to Arizona. So how did you reply when your publisher came to you with the idea to team up two characters?
I said, sure, I can do that. And then I started trying to do it, and it turned into a big problem. I've been writing about Bo, my Seattle homicide detective, for more than 30 years. But in writing Dance of the Bones, I discovered that when he was growing up in Seattle, he obviously never attended kindergarten because he had no idea of how to play well with others. And I'd be trying to write a Brandon Walker scene, and Bo would walk in and take things over and say, me, 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 tell my story first. And eventually, the only way to get him to sit down and shut up was to do exactly that, to tell his story first. So I took the part of his story that had become a roadblock in Dance of the Bones, turned it into a separate novella. Once I did that, I was able to get him to shape up and do what I needed him to do in Dance of the Bones.
You're so familiar with certain aspects of Native American culture from your previous life, if we can put it that way, from your time living in Bisbee and your teaching on reservations. How important a role does that play in Dance of the Bones? And is there an extra knowledge you bring to it? Did you have to do more research?
I did have to do more research. I learned a little more Tohono O'odham grammar in the process. I went to the reservation as a complete stranger to Indian traditions or mores or beliefs or any of those things. What I knew about Indians was all from the history books. And guess what? the history books get written by the winners. And so I was completely naive about Indians. And yet I went there. I was there for 5 years. My friends on the reservation took me in. They made me part of their circle. They taught me what I know of Tohono O'odham lore and legend. And when I left 5 years later, I was a different person from the one who drove into town that September morning. And I believe I was a better person. This is a story. It's that murder mystery. But the other part of the story is Brandon Walker's daughter, adoptive daughter, Lonnie, like her whole tribe of people, lives with 1 foot in the modern world with the internet and microwaves and computers, but with the other foot firmly in the traditions of the desert people. She is a trained physician. She is the emergency room doctor at the hospital itself. But she's also a trained medicine woman. Ancient traditions are an important part of this book.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with best-selling novelist J.A. Jantz. You've obviously written a lot in the Pacific Northwest, a lot in the Southwest. You live in both places. Is it better, worse? Does it matter where you're at when you're writing the story? When you're in Arizona, do you want to write about the Arizona characters? Does it matter?
Sometimes it's easier to write about a place when I'm not actually in it, because that forces me to put what I know into words rather than seeing it. But most of the time, it doesn't matter, because what happens is between my brain and my fingertips and the keyboard. Arizona is my home, but Seattle is my creative home, because that's where I first had courage enough to start living my lifelong dream of becoming a writer.
And you got shot down a lot, which I found amazing.
I got shot down mostly in Arizona. I wasn't allowed in the creative writing program at the U of A because, as the professor told me, I was a girl. As a 20-year-old, I was devastated by that and thought I had lost all chance of living my dream. But it turns out, if I had been allowed admission to a class where the professor was predisposed to fail me, I probably would have failed, and I might have lost the dream of becoming a writer by not being in that. Actually, I consider not being in that class a very fortunate stroke of luck.
I've heard you tell the story that you have gone by J.A. because your publisher wasn't sure if readers would buy a female writer creating a series with a male detective. Has the publishing world, the greater world, changed enough that if you were just developing a strong base now, you've written a couple of books, let's say, could you go by Judy or Judith?
I think I could go by Judith now, but I'm very grateful I don't have to. Because when I'm autographing books, I can tell you J.A. is a lot easier to sign than Judith Ann. Far fewer letters.
I don't want to belabor it, but I'm curious as to your thoughts. I mean, you're such a powerful influence in the publishing industry. Does it matter that you're a female who's a powerful influence?
I can tell you that female writers still get a lot less critical attention than the male writers do. I have more than 50 books out. I've been on the New York Times list countless times. I have been reviewed by the New York Times once only. That was back when I was still in original paperback. So it's all the way back to the late 80s.
Wow.
And the reviewer said, J.A. Jantz has created a nice little cottage industry for herself, writing her funny little books. And that was the reason Sisters in Crime was started, to address the disparity in reviewing. So that still exists. And so I'd like to think it would be okay to be Judith Ann these days, but I'm not sure it would be any different.
Best-selling novelist J.A. Jantz, her latest book is called Dance of the Bones, and she'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix tonight and Poison Pen in Scottsdale on Thursday night. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The number of professional theater companies in Arizona is decreasing, and the state's largest one, Arizona Theater Company, is on the verge of some major leadership changes. One piece of good news is the company is showing a surplus rather than a deep deficit. In Sunday's Arizona Republic, arts writer and theater critic Carrie Lengel looked closely at what's gone on at ATC and what could be next. And he joins me now. Good morning, Carrie. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's look at the financial picture. It is much better. What has happened to make that occur?
Well, a lot of things. Obviously, after the recession hit, arts organizations all across the country were in trouble, and they were all slashing their budgets. Arizona Theater Company did that just like everybody else. Theaters have a little more flexibility than, say, a symphony or the ballet. They can do a musical with two people or four people instead of a cast of 15 and save a lot of money that way. But Arizona Theater Company, as the top dog in town, if you will, they have... They are the only company that works on a national level. It goes to New York to audition on a regular basis, L.A., Chicago, and brings in that kind of national talent. So they have a lot of overhead and a lot of costs, and they had a very large deficit 2 years ago of $1 million. This year, the fiscal year that just ended, they do have a modest surplus of about $200,000, and they did that through, you know, a combination of some extra fundraising and et cetera. The real question is, where are they moving forward? Because they had a big fundraising drive at the end of the year. They raised $1.3 million. And without that big fundraising drive, it could have been another bad year for them.
What are some of the challenges of being a company that does shows in Phoenix and Tucson? Does that add financial challenges, logistical challenges as well?
It definitely adds logistical challenges. When I talk to David Ira Goldstein, the artistic director, though, he emphasizes the positive of that, which is that they produce the show once and then they sell it twice.
Okay. So David Ira Goldstein, you mentioned, has been the artistic director for so many years, a couple of decades at this point. He is finally moving on. He had anticipated retiring a couple of years ago. So big leadership changes on the horizon. The interim managing director, Matt Lehrman, is moving on as well. So what's the process going to be like? How long could it be, and who will be involved in the selection of these major roles?
How long it could take, who knows? They do not have a timeline. I'm going to guess 6 months at a minimum, possibly as much as a year, based on, you know, similar searches that we've seen at other companies. They have retained a firm that an LA-based consulting firm that does this. And the process is, first of all, they come in and they talk to all the stakeholders at ATC to get a feel for, you know, where they're at, what are their goals, and then they're going to come back with recommendations on how to conduct a search. So they're really at the beginning stages. One of the things is that one of the people working on this search is David Hawkinson, who was a artistic director at ATC many years ago, and then he moved on to the Guthrie Theater in Minnesota and then Steppenwolf in Chicago. He knows the theater world very well, and they are going to be shaping their search based on, you know, what ATC's vision is of the future.
Based on what you know about theater, is ATC in any way behind the curve? Are there certain things they're going to try to catch up with that next management team?
Well, there's no question that they've seen a lot of troubles. They're not unique in that. You know, theater companies all across the country are in similar straits. But because they are big, that makes it harder to change and to deal with it. You know, if you're a very small company, you can kind of roll with the punches a little better than when you're a bigger one.
So I'm wondering then, when we look at the season that is put together, and of course, David puts so much into that, is there something with this? And we talked about the complications of a Phoenix audience and what that is. If you do six shows, let's say, a season, you probably want to have some traditional stuff, some maybe edgy stuff, but attendance, based on your story, has gone down. So how do you find, I'm not going to ask you to program a season, but in general, what do you think about, what does an artistic director think about when putting together a season that can appeal to a broader audience?
Well, one of the things ATC does is they are the broadest in their programming. They always do a musical or two. They always do some very serious, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning drama.
Right, right.
And they always do something a little lighter. And they really try to mix it up that way. The thing is, though, that that strategy clearly isn't necessarily working as well as it has in the past. Mm-hmm. Matt Lehrman did tell me that last year they did a world premiere show called Five Presidents that did very well, but every other show they had on their season performed underperformed based what they were expecting to happen. Okay. So part of this is just the evolution of the arts and how much competition there is. You know, a ticket to ATC costs a lot of money, and I don't know about how much your Netflix subscription is, but you get a whole lot of binge watching in for not a lot of money.
So one of the things you mentioned in the piece that I found interesting is, not that it's unique, but this push to get more Latinos potentially interested. And I wonder about sort of the challenges of that, because obviously we have such a huge Latino population here, but does that in any way, do you risk alienating the average ATC audience to get people who may or may not ultimately be interested? There's got to be, I imagine, a huge push in order to get one audience that doesn't really know about you to know about you and also balance that other part too.
That balancing act is the perennial issue. And ATC's audience is a little older than maybe some other theaters. They rely very strongly on their subscription base, the season ticket holders who come year in, year out. Mm-hmm. But they don't do as well selling those single tickets to people who are interested in just this one title. So it really depends on what the programming is. Last season they did a weekend with Pablo Picasso, mm-hmm. And they did some Spanish language performances of that. And that is definitely something that is in their wheelhouse in terms of a play that's about art. But it's definitely an issue, and you're seeing that at Arizona Opera, for example, where they are also pushing hard with that. They did a mariachi opera last year, and they are doing another Spanish language opera this year. Some traditionalists might balk.
Arts writer and theater critic Carrie Langle of the Arizona Republic. Carrie, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their assistance on today's program. Thank you very much for listening. NPR's Here and Now is up next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. If you missed any part of the program, go online to kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Arts Center, presenting the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra led by Wynton Marsalis on Friday, September 25th. Tickets and dinner packages available at mesaartscenter.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Republican presidential candidates are preparing to make their case to voters at tonight's second primary debate of the season. NPR's Sarah McCammon reports those polling in the bottom tier will take part in a much smaller event.
The 11 candidates at the top of the polls will face off in a primetime debate at 8 Eastern Time at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California. The stage will be extra crowded since CNN revised its eligibility criteria, allowing former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina in the main event. She was a standout in the undercard forum at last month's debate in Cleveland, and she's seen a boost in some recent polls. Four remaining candidates whose poll numbers were too low to qualify for primetime will debate at 6 Eastern. That group is smaller after former Texas Governor Rick Perry dropped out of the race and former Virginia Governor Jim Gilmore failed to qualify to participate in either debate. Sarah McCammon, NPR News, Washington.
President Obama is expressing confidence that the Pacific Rim nations will finalize an agreement on a free trade pact this year. But he told a group of corporate executives during the business roundtable that predicting the U.S. Congress's actions will be difficult.
I'll be honest with you. The reason is that the policy.